Hello there, and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus and on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. And today my guests are Adrian Sharp and Karen Joy Fowler. Adrian was on the show before with her first book, a short story collection, White Swan, Black Swan. She studied ballet from the age of 7 and trained with the Harkness Ballet in New York. She received an MA from the Johns Hopkins University and was awarded a fellowship in fiction at the University of Virginia. She lives in Los Angeles. Hi, Adrian.
Hi, Barbara.
Great to have you on. Your new book, First Love, published by Riverhead, is just a wonderful book. And once again, you're dealing with the arena of dance. And I think it's really kind of interesting because I don't think I can think of another novel that really focuses on dance the way that you do. And you come from it in a very personal way. Will you talk about that? How you found your way to writing, and then how dance found its way into your writing?
Well, it's a bit of a life split into half, because the first part of my life was all about ballet. I started taking dance when I was 7 years old at the local ballet school without any idea of what I was getting into, and within a few years found myself on scholarship studying every single day. And this continued all the way through high school and until I won a scholarship to go to New York and be a trainee for Harkness Ballet, which was a 2-year program. First year, you're a scholarship girl. Second year, you're an apprentice to the company. But I left after just a few months, realizing once I was in New York that I, in some ways, just wasn't up to the demands of the training and the life there, and also not up to maybe the emotional demands of being a young girl very much on her own in a big city, in a big school where the teachers were not going to be looking out for you or coddling you. And I put all my leotards and point shoes away, and after a brief period of despair and disorganization, went off to college and found myself drawn to literature and writing. But it was, 10 years more, I think, before I began to realize that all the dancing I had done and seeing could actually be material for my work. And it wasn't until I was a Hoynes Fellow in Virginia that I ventured into using my dance background at all in fiction. And I remember showing a story to Peter Taylor. I was studying with him at the time. And he read it and said, you need to really figure out what you want to say about this world of dancers, their lives, the themes and the issues of this world. And I think I really wasn't sure what themes or issues I wanted to explore at that time. And it wasn't really until 5 years more after that that I turned to this material in earnest and began to realize that I had a lot to say about the world of ballet, which, as you point out, has not been covered much in adult fiction. There are lots of stories for little girls about dancers or little mice that are dancers and Angelina Ballerina, but not very much fiction for adults.
No, and there's so many women, too, that and men, I imagine, too, but women who were those little girls who were dancers, and teenagers that were dancers, and younger women that were dancers who read books and... God, it just seems that you have carved out a very organic niche for yourself in the world of fiction.
Well, it's interesting to draw those readers in because although they're not dancing anymore, as you say, they are readers and they've now assumed different positions in the world. They have time to read, unlike dancers who dance 14 hours a day or too exhausted for the most part to do anything more than that. And I have found among my readership people who, recognize themselves in some of the characters and find some of the themes very resonant for them in their own lives.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. And yet it, Why do I say and yet? Because what I'm about to say is that, and yet it's not a romance novel. It's a literary novel. And that's not to disparage romance fiction. You know, it's like, but I think when you hear of perhaps fiction revolving around the world of ballet, maybe you think romance. And even though it's a relationship, you're dealing with two young dancers in a ballet company. You're writing, there's such care to the writing and the language. Is this when you started writing, were you this kind of writer? Did you struggle to figure out what you wanted to write, what genre you wanted to write in, or was it just pretty natural what started happening?
I think always because of the schools I went to and the types of teachers I studied with, that literary fiction was going to be the genre, and I was never really interested in writing poetry or plays or working in any other genre. So it was fiction from the start. I guess that's not my first love, but my second love. But it is true that although there's a romance at the center of this book, the first loves in it are many. We have Balanchine's first love of ballet that informed and enriched his life. We have in Sandra's character the first love of Balanchine, whom she worships and can't leave. And then in Adam, the third character whose point of view we see in this novel, his first love for him is life, and he feels that dance has stolen away many of the things that he wants in life.
Interesting. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Adrienne Sharp, author of First Love. The story is set in the 80s. Is that because of Balanchine, namely? And how did you decide then that Balanchine was going to be a sort of a focus of this book?
I think in researching my first book, White Swan, Black Swan, I was interested in what I read about Balanchine, that he fell in love with ballet while performing a child's role in Sleeping Beauty, and that he carried this dream the rest of his life, unfulfilled, to restage that ballet for a company of his own. And here's a man who fulfilled so many dreams and had so many wives, and yet at the end of his life wasn't able to do this last ballet, and never really had a family or children.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting also because he hated ballet at first. He was dragged along when his sister Tamara auditioned at the Imperial Ballet School, and they figured since he's along, he might as well try out too. And she didn't get in, and he did. And he was miserable there. He hated the exercises and the classes and the loneliness and the dormitory, and he kept running away, running back to the St. Petersburg apartment and having his aunt hide him until she would feel guilty sneaking dinners and napkins to him in her room and turn him over to his parents, and then he'd be sent back. And he recalls very vividly being on the stage at the Mariinsky, seeing the Tsar in his imperial box. He was in the third act of Sleeping Beauty, which is the wedding of Aurora and Prince Desiree, and he was a Cupid in the entourage of one of the six fairies, the fairy Canary. And she was inside a golden cage, and he was adornment on the cage, sitting on the lip of it. And he recalls very exactly seeing the magic of this ballet unfold. They had real horses on the stage. They had fountains that from which real water would flow. He saw legends of the Imperial Ballet and their very elaborate costumes, which cost one quarter of the theater's entire budget for that year. It was a real production. And he fell in love with ballet and with stagecraft. And I think both of those things he brought with him to Europe and then to America and was fascinated by his whole life.
Interesting. Will you read to us? Will you read from First Love?
What I'm going to read is the prologue. The book is set up into five sections. It follows the order of the story and also of the ballet. So there's a prologue which corresponds to Aurora's christening, where she receives the gifts from the fairies. And what I did is allowed each one of my three characters, Sandra, then Adam, her lover and ballet star to rival company, and Balanchine, each have a scene that dramatizes their initiation into the world of dance, which is going to govern their lives. She wore an outfit she'd selected herself, especially for the occasion. Textured mesh tights, a bathing suit, party shoes, and in her long hair, a large artificial flower, a peony, plucked from her dead mother's hat. As they walked the hallways of Juilliard's third floor toward the big studio, Sandra held her father's hand. They were thinking she might take some kind of dance class, maybe tap, but the lady on the phone said she would have to come into the school to audition. All around them were other girls, and she hadn't known there would be other girls, 100 girls wearing leotards and pink tights and ballet slippers, their hair braided and pinned, and immediately upon seeing them, Sandra wanted to go home. She tugged on her father's hand, but he ignored her. He was fascinated by what they'd stumbled into, this secret world within the world. He pushed her forward to have a number pinned to her bathing suit, filled out a form. They had to wait. Her name was called Sandra Ellis. She was measured, told to point her foot, lift her leg. Two elderly Russian ladies examined her from all sides, conferring first in their own language and then speaking in heavily accented English to her father. She was gifted. She was beautiful. She was admitted to the school. There was no tap class. This was the School of American Ballet. Adam wandered the loft, holding his mother's glove, the one with a fur cuff, and the big empty space of his house opened like cement acreage before him. He could just make out the murky image of himself, a dwarf, reflected in the polished concrete floors. The dwarf's arm flapped, the glove, which he was slipping as he walked. His parents weren't home, hadn't been home, would never be home, and it was dark, past his bedtime, the big windows, sheets of blackness. On the sofa in the center of the loft, his godfather Randall sat reading aloud, and when Adam passed him, put out an arm. "Come here." Adam crawled onto his lap, and Randall let him turn the pages of the fairy tale book until he found the story he wanted. A boy climbing a beanstalk, a briar-covered castle, a princess in a pumpkin coach, a wolf following a girl. This one. Randall began the story. Adam slid the fur part of his mother's glove along his chin. "Are they still at the theater?" Randall nodded and continued to read. Adam yawned. At the theater, his parents wore costumes and makeup, but they didn't speak. They danced to music. Randall turned the page. The wolf swallowed a granny whole. The theater was like that. It had opened its jaws and swallowed his parents. Women in costumes enveloped him, pushing past him toward the stage where the oiled canvas dropped. From the wing where he stood, little Georgie Balanchine could see beyond the proscenium to the dark and blue and gold facade of the Mariinsky's interior. He was inside a Fabergé egg, all beauty and artifice, an egg that held within it even the Tsar himself, Nicholas II, seated above the stage in the imperial box embellished with his royal insignia. On the stage, real water erupted from the cascading fountains, half hidden behind the great stone arches and elaborate statuary of the castle. And within the hall itself stood pages and heralds, king and queen, the resplendent lords and ladies of the court, the draped cradle of the baby Aurora, the genies bearing gifts, and the 6 fairy godmothers, the fairy Candide, the fairy Fleur de Farine, the Britcomplery, the fairy Violente, the fairy Canary, the lilac fairy. Georgie, already dressed in his garland costume for the next scene, stood rigid, exhausted and euphoric, and gripped his small prop, a wooden stick glued round with cloth flowers. It was his first time in the theater, and the steps he had practiced over and over again in the school studios were now being executed to perfection on the Tsar's stage by the legends of the Imperial Ballet. The ballet he watched so intently was Sleeping Beauty, and as the lilac fairy waved her wand, she dusted with her gold magic the king, the queen, the stage, its players, and the little boy standing spellbound in the wings.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Adrienne Sharp reading from First Love, published by Riverhead Books. As you were reading, I started wondering about, well, a lot of things, but the last thing I was wondering was how it is to write about somebody who was so famous, who lived, and what, if there were any worries. I mean, the book is represents Balanchine in such a favorable way, but is there anything you have to think about or consider, or do you have to, you know, have your book vetted by attorneys before it can see publication, in case there's anything at all that could be, you know, that the estate could find difficult?
I think that with all public figures, there isn't that kind of worry. Balanchine has been written about so much in so many biographies, so many articles, in essays of his own, and by many of his ex-wives and dancers. So he's very much a public figure, and the details that I drew from his life came from these already published sources. But there is a sense of daring in entering the mind of someone else, whether it's Balanchine or any other character that kind of dare to presume to know how they feel. And there was a great pleasure in imagining how he felt while moving through scenes I'd read about. And for some people, this will be exciting, and for other people, there's a sense of violation. And I imagine that's true for any reader who loves a public figure, and that public figure is then the subject of a piece of art. You know, Maria Callas in Masterclass, for example, Virginia Woolf in Michael Cunningham's The Hours. In both of those pieces and many more, writers dare to enter the mind of this public figure and imagine how he thinks and feels. But I think readers know that the George Balanchine in this book is one of my imagination.
Interesting. Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. I mean, I don't know. It is troublesome if you're writing about someone living, but, you know, it's just it's something writers deal with an awful lot, you know, when they deal with...
True, and not always with public figures. So many writers are writing about their friends, sisters, ex-wives, and entering
right.
their minds and turning them into characters, too.
Well, in your fiction, your short fiction, have you done that? Have you based characters on people you've known? And if so, how have you done it?
Usually they're composites. It'll be uh-huh. something about someone that fascinates you, and you take that and are creating a character from him or her. So it's sometimes more direct and fuller portrait, and sometimes just a partial portrait that got your mind going, that you found interesting and just needed to write about.
Sure. Interesting. Well, we have a few minutes left with Adrienne Sharp, author of First Love. I know you've had the same agent for your first book of short stories and this book.
Mm-hmm.
Was it difficult... First of all, having your first book be a collection of short stories and selling that, and was there ever any, difficulty in selling the novel or the short stories because they were so focused on dance? Or was that really an advantage to pick something to really focus in on something that really wasn't being done?
I'm not sure about that. I think in general it was harder to place short story collections, and that was true for me as well. The book went around a bit until Random House made its offer, and it sold very well for a collection of stories, about three times as well as collections usually sell, and I attribute that to the cover, which drew people
yes.
to it who were interested in ballet. So I think it didn't work as an advantage when selling it, but it did work as an advantage once it was in the stores. The novel was much, much easier to sell. We had, you know, a number of offers on it every place we went. So I think in that case, the idea that it was a novel and that it explored a particular time in the ballet world, the early 80s ballet boom, when we had Baryshnikov taking over ballet theater and still dancing, when we had Balanchine creating his great last works. The fact that it was a window into a very, for some people, exotic world worked as an advantage for me.
Interesting. Gosh, we have another couple of minutes left, and I always have, like, too many questions. But I wondered, too, about the research you had to do for this book. Did you do a ton of research before you actually started writing, or did you use a lot of the information you already had, and or were you writing it and researching it all at once?
A lot of research went into the book. Not only did I read every Balanchine biography there was, but then I also tracked down all the sources used for those biographies. So I was reading articles and memoirs and essays and contacting people, talking to various people, asking people questions about Balanchine, about Sleeping Beauty, about life in New York City Ballet at that time, so that I could really get a sense of what it would be like to be a student at the School of American Ballet at that time, what Balanchine's health and demeanor was like at that time. And sometimes I wish I didn't even know. Now I know more than I even want to know sometimes because I would go see New York City Ballet when they came here to Los Angeles, and then I'd hear people talking in intermission, and one young man would say, yes, he made Aegon for his last wife, Suzanne Farrell, and that's why the ballet's so gorgeous, and just about every fact that he said was wrong. And I knew that. I have more knowledge than I even want. So
yes.
I feel like I've become a little bit of an amateur dance historian in making this journey. And I also learned more about the Sleeping Beauty legend than I wanted to know, which is actually came from rather horrific origins, because in all the earlier fables and stories, the princess is felled by a spindle prick and then raped by either someone she knows or a suitor of hers. And she doesn't wake until she gives birth to the child of that union, which then suckles at her finger, thinking it's her breast, and draws out the spindle. And then the princess awakes to this ruin, the ruination of her virginity, these children that she didn't know she was carrying, and in the end is married to the man who rapes her. And then that man has to defend her against his angry mother or wife who wants to kill her and the children. A lot of that's been lopped off in the Grimm Brothers version of the tale.
Yeah, yeah.
But I retained a lot of those elements in my novel, all those themes of trespass, magic, transformation, betrayal, sleeping, and death are all themes that I wove into this book, which I found so fascinating.
Yeah, interesting. Oh, and we're at the end of our time, and I want to mention your appearance. You're going to be at Warwick's in La Jolla on July 21st at 7:30.
That's right.
Yep. Okay, and Warwick's is just a wonderful store down in the San Diego area, so if you're anywhere near there, or it's worth making the trek from Orange County to get down to Warwick's to see Adrian. Will you be reading?
I'll be speaking about the book and reading a passage or two from it, yes.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Barbara, for having me. Always a pleasure.
Quite welcome. That was Adrian Sharp, author of First Love. She spoke to us from Los Angeles. When we return, we should be here with Karen Joy Fowler, author of the Jane Austen Book Club. Please stay tuned.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama, ache and tears. Be gone 24 hours, child, seem like 1,000 years. come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time. One belt in a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus and on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Before we go on, let me say that the opinions and views that you hear on the show are those of me and my guests and not those of the University of California, Irvine Regents. My next guest is Karen Joy Fowler, author of the Jane Austen Book Club, and this is Karen's second book. Her first novel was called Sister Noon, or is called Sister Noon, published by Putnam, Marion Wood imprint, published in May of 2001. She's written many short stories. She's written for magazines. She has taught at Stanford, so much, and I am just so delighted to have her on. Are you there, Karen?
I am, yes. Thank you very much. I'm thrilled to be here.
Great to have you. I love this book, and I will confess from the beginning that while I respect and admire Jane Austen so much and have read her work, I'm not a fan. I mean, I'm not a, you know, I have nothing bad to say about her. But when I started reading the book, I wondered if I would need to be a fan to really get into the book, and I found that it was so fascinating. I almost became a fan, really, you know, because the book is just so wonderful. And it, you know, the story of a book club reading all of Jane Austen's work, I found that just so interesting as a focus for the book, and also how you could, through that, make someone like me, who, again, is not, you know, has no problem with Jane Austen, but make me so interested that, you know, I'm going out to my studio looking for Jane Austen books, putting them on my stack, going, you know, I think I want to read this again.
Well, nothing pleases me more than to hear that. Thank you so much.
Will you talk about how the Jane Austen Book Club came about?
Actually, as opposed to everything else I've ever written, which I come to with so much struggle and, you know, think I'm going to write about this, and then it turns out I'm not, and think I'm going to write about that, and it turns out I'm not. This was just a kind of a lightning strike of an idea. I was at a bookstore in the Bay Area waiting for a friend of mine to start a reading that he was going to do, and just kind of glancing around the store, and there was a sign on the wall that said the Jane Austen Book Club, and because I was in a bookstore, there was just a moment where I thought it was the title of a book. And I am a huge Austen fan. I've read her since over and over again since I was about 14. So my immediate reaction was, I have been waiting for that book my whole life. And in the time it took me to figure out that it was not a book, that it was in fact a book club, I also figured out that it was probably a book I could write if nobody else had written it, and with a certain amount of haste, I thought, because there was the sign, writers walking in and out of this store all the time. I thought, just hanging there, an idea for anyone to take. I have to move fast.
Interesting. That's really interesting. So you saw the posting, and you said, this is a book. You didn't think this is a story, this is an essay. It came to you.
Yes, pretty much, again, you know, not my usual writing experience, but the entire structure of the book, which is divided into six sections,
each section is involved with a particular Austen novel, but also involved with a particular character of mine. So the book club has six people in it. Each of the sections focuses on a different person in the club. All of that came to me that first night. So, no, I didn't know the details. I didn't know what anybody's stories would be, but I could sort of see the overview of the book in a way that, let me say again, never, never, never happens. I usually write a book the way a lot of writers do, sort of feeling my way forward, maybe, if I'm lucky, knowing what the next page will have on it, but never knowing what the next 50 pages will have. And so to start a book with the entire sort of shape in my mind was a strange and delightful experience.
Hmm. Now, how much did you know then of the structure of the book before you began? Did you do an elaborate plot? Did you outline the characters? How much did you know, and how much was a discovery?
Just the part I said, you know, that I knew it would be six sections, that I knew there would be six people in the club, and that I knew part of each chapter would be paying some sort of attention to a particular Austen novel. I knew that I would be using the Austen novels as inspiration, and I saw fairly quickly, if I didn't see it right away, that I would have to be kind of cunning about the ways in which I did that, that it just was not going to be plausible in a book club where people were actively reading and thinking about Austen's work if their lives actually resembled the works they were reading too closely. You know, it would not be plausible that they would not be saying at every moment, why, it's just like Elizabeth and Darcy, why, it's just like Anne and Wentworth. So I wanted there to be echoes of the books that they were looking at, but I wanted them to be very subtle and not, things that my own characters would be able to overlook, and therefore things that readers would also be able to overlook. I very much hoped that I would be able to write a book that a person who knew Austen's work well would enjoy little bits and pieces of, but that a person who did not know Austen's work well or at all would still be able to read with pleasure. You know, the main book is a contemporary novel about my characters, and Austen is the backdrop, but I hope that that you can still enjoy the book without feeling that you need to know anything about Austen.
Yeah, you sure can. Yeah, I absolutely love this book. I
Thank
picked
you.
It up and really didn't want to put it down, and I love it when that happens.
I do too, and I especially love it when people tell me that happens with my book.
Another something in this book that I found really interesting that works so well is you have different point of view characters. And as I recall, I don't think you actually even changed chapters to get into different point of view characters. But in any case, it just works so well, and so often it's clunky, or you go, you know, I really don't want to be in this point of view character. I really wish they would have, you know, just stayed with these, you know, one, two, or three characters. But you're dealing with so many different characters, and they all are interesting and compelling.
Thank you. That's wonderful to hear. You know, of course, anytime you switch from one person's story to another person's story, you run the risk that one of the two stories will be more compelling and more interesting, and that people will, you know, be sort of tapping their foot, waiting to get back to the story they like better. So you always run a risk when you switch, and I hope that it paid off. As you said, people ask me fairly frequently which of my own characters in the book I like the best, and I truly don't have a favorite. So I hope that is a clue that maybe I have succeeded in making them equally interesting. At least they were equally interesting to me.
Yeah, you sure have. I'm talking with Jane Austen. I'm talking with Karen Joy Fowler, who is channeling Jane Austen, author of the Jane Austen Book Club, published in paperback, in trade paperback by Plume. I didn't know this when I read the book, and now it makes absolute sense, but I see from your website that you have written a lot of science fiction, short stories.
I have. I've, in general, sort of had a two-prong career in that my novels have all been literary mainstream publications, but my short fiction has all been in the genres and has mainly been science fiction and fantasy. Not in some ways not what a lot of people who don't know much about science fiction and fantasy picture exactly. I don't do spaceships. I'm not really technologically savvy. I can't guess what the future is going to look like. But I do have in these stories things happen or moments that are not realist. There are things that could not happen. They're fantastical things. I always say in my own way that the world we live in now, I think, with cloning and pig hearts, and my current favorite example is a world in which Arnold Schwarzenegger can be elected governor of California, is to me not a world that you can adequately convey in realist fiction.
Yes.
So I tend to reach for the fantastical in my attempts to suggest what I think the real world looks like, which is kind of wacky.
Well, and after finding this out, your character of Grig sort of came into more focus.
I see. That's why you said it made sense, because of Grig. Yes. One of the things I was thinking about when I started writing the book, and one of the things that interested me about Austin is, you know, not just that I love her work and not just that a lot of people love her work, but the people who love her work most engage with it so deeply that whole communities form around it. So there are conventions and people get together and dress in Austin clothes, and, you know, they really wish they could live in the books, at least briefly. And it struck me, because I do know the science fiction world quite well, as something very similar to the science fiction conventions. Again, a literature that somehow inspires a community around it, as well as just being a good read for a lot of people. So I was thinking a lot about that, and I was thinking, why do some authors and some literatures do that, and other equally good books don't make you, you know, want to get together and pretend that you actually live in the book, and how odd that two things that you would think, you know, there couldn't be two literatures more different than Jane Austen and science fiction, that they should share this kind of attachment among the readers, struck me as really interesting. So I wanted to, for that reason, to put the two of them together in the single book.
Yeah, it's interesting. Your characters have such a range of ages. You have very young characters, and you have, you know, I wouldn't say elderly, but, you know, some women getting up there.
Yeah.
And I like that so much, that you have this range of ages in characters, and I wonder how much thought went into that, and was there ever any, oh, I don't know, there's, you know, in fiction, it seems that when you're writing about women, you know, the 40s are kind of, you know, as far as you go with that, and they must be younger. And even in a lot of literary fiction, you know, we're dealing with female characters in their, you know, 20s, 30s, 40s, and not much beyond that. How much thought did you give?
Well, you've hit on something that I think about a lot. I think you're absolutely right. And my novel prior to this, Sister Noon, has a middle-aged woman in her 40s as my protagonist, and I myself am getting up there. I'm 55 now, so if I ever thought that older women, middle-aged and above, did not belong in great books, I certainly no longer think that. I now think they're fascinating subjects for books, but I do think there's a commercial barrier there that you always hear that men don't wish to read books by and about women, and I think when you add an older woman in, you also a lot of younger women don't wish to read books about older women, and all I can say about it is that it annoys me greatly.
Well, fortunately, there's a ton of baby boomers who do want to read about it.
And fortunately for me, as it turns out, a whole bunch of them are in book clubs. This is kind of the book club set.
Yes. Well, and you have so many great blurbs. I mean, you know, a lot of much younger women have loved this book, and men, and it was a New York Times bestseller. So obviously, you know, age was not a deterrent to people grabbing onto this book and loving it. And I'm just so happy to see that.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you so much.
I think that's great. Will you read to us? Read to us for a few minutes.
I will, sure. The section I thought I would read is actually a bit about the chapter that deals with the oldest woman in the group, although she's remembering her youth, and it's about her first marriage. She has, by the time my book takes place, had many, many, many marriages, but this is just a little bit about the first one. So I think the only thing that may be confusing and that I should fill you in on is the fact that prior to running off and getting married, she was in a tap dancing troupe, and she makes a brief reference to that. After Lloyd and Maddie left to get married, Madame Dubois said we couldn't any of us date anymore, as it was bad for the act if we got reputations. We were to remember we were ladies. So John and I snuck around, and finally I left my dancing shoes behind, and we ran off and got married in Vegas at the wee Kirk of the Heather. There was the nicest woman working there, Cynthia something or other. I remember she said she'd been a clerk at Woolworth before this job, and she missed the free fabric end she used to get. Isn't that funny, the things you remember? The chapel had some dresses, and I tried them all on, but they were too big for me. I really was the tiniest thing back then, couldn't fit into anything off the rack. So Cynthia altered a skirt for me right on the spot, and she combed my hair and did my makeup. There were couples ahead of us. We had a bit of a wait. She gave me a cigarette. I never smoked in my life, but just this one time, the occasion seemed to call for it. Cynthia pointed out how now I was going to be Nettie Andretti. I'd never even thought of that. I was going by Nettie then. That's the day I began using my full name, Bernadette. While she did my hair, Cynthia told me this story, how there was a curse on her family because her grandpa had once hit a pure white cat with his car. He said it was an accident, but it probably wasn't, because ever since, when anyone in the family was about to die, they saw a white cat. Her uncle saw a white cat from his bedroom window when he was only 26. It streaked through the yard, grabbed one of his socks from the clothesline, and made off over the fence with it. And then he went out that very night with some friends and got killed in a bar fight by someone who thought he was someone else. They never did find that sock. Cynthia was in the middle of telling me this. She had just said how her mother said she didn't believe in any of that nonsense, and to prove it, went out and bought herself a white cat. I know something weird happened next because of the way Cynthia was telling it, but I never heard what. John and I were called just then, and I had to go get married. I was in a bad mood when I said my vows because I wanted to hear the end of the white cat story. I've always wondered how that ended.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that was Karen Joy Fowler reading from the Jane Austen Book Club, published by Plume. What are you reading now?
You know, I have been touring quite a bit, which means I've been on a lot of planes and in a lot of hotel rooms, and the joy of it has been that I have just been reading constantly. There are a lot of really good books out there. I just read Cloud Atlas by David Mitchell, which I liked enormously. I read The Position by Meg Wolitzer, which I thought was wonderful. I just read Lord Byron's novel by John Crowley, a book about, in which, as the title suggests, a lost novel by Byron suddenly surfaces, kind of a possession-like story, and that there's parts of the book are the lost novel, but parts of it are the story of how it got lost and a contemporary story about it being found again.
Do you do any writing when you're touring?
I don't. There are so many ways in which I feel like a fraud. I hear other writers talk, and there's so many times when I think, oh yes, see, that's a real writer, and this is one of them. I feel if I were a real writer, I would be able to work in a hotel room. I would be able to work on a plane. Nothing would stop me. Instead, I'm just this horrible prima donna that has to have everything just so. You know, it's not enough that I not be interrupted. I have to know I'm not going to be interrupted.
Sure.
I have to be assured that I won't be interrupted. There's no excuse for it, particularly, you know, I read about Austin. I think about her scribbling away and shoving things under her blotter while family life swirls about her, and I'm just so ashamed.
Well, I think you're doing fine.
Thank
so
you. That was a plea.
Don't worry about
like
it.
Something like
that. No, I mean, it's, yeah, it's interesting. You know, you would think hotel rooms would give you sort of the solace to be able to work, and they don't necessarily, but they do give you the time to read.
Yes.
So
it's been fabulous.
Well, what about when people ask you, what are you working on now? I mean, I've had this happen since my book came out in October, and I don't know what to say because I don't want to let the air out of the projects, and I don't want to be sort of arrogant or snobby.
Yeah, you don't want to pretend that you're too precious to answer these questions.
What
I
do
know
you say
exactly
to that?
What you mean. But in my case, it's all made quite easy by the fact that I'm not working on anything. So I'm very hopeful that I will soon be working on something. I'm thinking about a project.
But, how long does a project gestate, and what's the process for you? I mean, is it sort of like what you said happened with the Jane Austen book club? You're just struck with something just hits you, and you go, this is it. And maybe it's a while that you wait. But is that what you trust, that will happen?
No. The Jane Austen Book Club is the only time that has ever happened. I guess on a couple of short stories, I've also had sort of a sudden revelation. But very, very rare. Mostly, I have to sort of put together several ideas until I have a core that's solid enough and has enough directions I can take it in to be worth writing a story about. So it's mostly a sort of accretion. I think, oh, yes, maybe I can use this little piece, and if I add this to it and I add that to it, and maybe this character could also be part of it. And eventually I have sort of enough. But most of my books are not as easily or completely structured as the Jane Austen Book Club was, and it's like I said, more of a mosaic kind of process of putting the pieces together until I have something big enough. I started writing short stories, and in a lot of ways that's still a form that I'm much more comfortable with.
Why is that?
Very simply, you know, for the obvious reason that they're shorter, and that the fact that they're shorter means that I can keep the whole piece in my mind at one time. You know, I can see how it works from beginning to end, and there's a very a sort of strangely predictable point in the novel when I can see the whole thing, I can see the whole thing, I can see the whole thing, and then page 120, almost to the paragraph, it's suddenly too big, and I can no longer see both the beginning and where I am anymore. I try then to work in sort of chunks, usually kind of three chapter chunks, where I can see from the beginning to the end of the chunk. But I will never again be able to sort of step back and see the whole of it, because it's just too big for me.
So then, do you work in, as you said, these three-chapter chunks, do you work on those chunks until they are shining before you go on to the next chapter? Or do you get a whole draft and then just go, okay, now?
No, I do the first. I work till it's shiny, which in many ways I know is not a smart way to work, because often, you know, these sentences, these paragraphs, these pages that I have polished and polished and rewritten, in fact, turn out not to be part of my novel at all. And so, you know, I end up dumping them, which would have made more sense to do before I fixed them all up. But partly It's, you know, simply that there's something sadly linear about my brain, and I just can't kind of go on to the next sentence unless I like the sentence in front of it. And partly, the part I like is the rewriting.
Oh, really?
So it's kind of a way of allowing myself to continually do the fun part, and the part I don't like, which is the first draft, you know, I'll do in bits. I'll push ahead a little bit. And sometimes, you know, making these psychotic little contracts with myself. You know, you write 3 new paragraphs today, and I will let you rewrite the last 10 pages.
That's funny. Gosh, we have another minute left, and I 2 questions. One is, was the prologue always the prologue? Was it there from the start, or did you do the prologue after you wrote the book?
I did do the prologue after I wrote the book. You're very perceptive.
And why? How
because
does that work?
I was getting from people, from my readers, a kind of panic that there were too many characters being introduced, that they couldn't keep track of everybody. And I fussed with it, and I fussed with it, and I thought, in the end, there are 6 characters. I can't really fix that. What I hoped I could do, and what I hoped the prologue would do, was at least calm you down to know that there are only 6.
Yes.
That, you know, when you've got those 6, you will be done. And that it won't go on endlessly with a new character and a new character. So that was my thinking, that it's just supposed to provide you with solace.
Yeah, and it works. It does. Yeah, it's true. It does settle you down, and you go, okay, yeah, I want to meet these people.
Good.
Yeah. And just my final question really is, any advice that you might have for the writers who are listening right now?
Gosh, I'm actually in Cleveland teaching at a writing conference, so I've been full of advice. I've done days and days of advice. It's hard to distill it down, but you know, besides the obvious, I guess I will stick to the obvious. I have taught in a great many workshops. I have been in a great many workshops. I have seen so many talented writers fail to be writers in so many ways, but by far the most common way is by not writing.
Mm. I mean,
it should be absolutely obvious that if you wish to be a writer, you actually must write. You must write a great deal, and yet, like I said, you know, every workshop I'm in, somebody fails to put that simple lesson together.
It's true. It's so true. There's enough talking about writing. It really takes putting the words down.
Yeah, sadly, yes.
Well, you have been a delight. I love your book.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This has been such a pleasure.
Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
That was Karen Joy Fowler, author of the Jane Austen Book Club and published by Plume. Love that book. Wish I hadn't read it so I could read it again right now and have it be fresh, but that's the way it goes.